Hello, I'm Gregor. I'm host of the Story Shop podcast. Today I'm talking to Andrew Flynn, who's the founder of Potter, the world's first origami self-watering plant pot. We talk about his journey right from school through to working at Dyson for a number of years, to the Kickstarter campaign to launch Potter, and where he is today. I hope you enjoy the chat. It'd be great to hear your thoughts at We Are Story Shop on social. Welcome to the Story Shop podcast.
Thank you very much. Lovely to be here, Gregor. Thanks for having me.
So tell us your story.
My story, long story. So I'm Andy Flynn. I am the founder of Potter Pots, founder and designer. Story began, starts with the fact that I'm a product designer and engineer, which started many years ago, probably in school, liking art and design, and ended up doing that at university, and have since worked for many years as a designer and engineer. Back in 2019, as many designers and engineers have, I was working on various side projects and decided one day in the pub after work with my mate Martin that we were going to try and reinvent the humble plant pot. This was the start of the Potter journey, so to speak. We basically decided to reinvent it from the ground up and created a flat pack self-watering plant pot which cares for your plants. We can get into more detail in a minute, but that's how it started, essentially.
How did that idea come about?
To be honest, one too many glasses of wine probably is the honest answer. But essentially, the kind of what we were trying to do was redesign a product as a case study from the ground up with sustainability at the core of the redesign. So that was the initial idea. Like, can we just redesign a standard household object? Both Martin and I are someone that have always, kind of for a long time, been into houseplants. So decided to take, essentially a standard concrete or ceramic plant pot as a case study. And essentially, how could you redesign this to be more sustainable? Interestingly, after looking at like a life cycle analysis of a standard plant pot, which is, a pretty niche thing to do, but looking at kind of where the carbon footprint pain points are throughout a typical plant pot's life cycle. And actually a big part of this is the transport and logistics associated with these products from when they're created in a factory, often somewhere in the Far East, to being distributed around the world. So this was how we kind of started looking into this and sparked a few ideas.
So how long was the process from coming up with the idea to going out announcing it was available?
So the actual design process, it was actually quite quick for compared to other projects I've worked on. Like, I've had side projects. The one before Potter, I was chipping away on one, which was this bike tool, which ended up being rubbish and went absolutely nowhere. But it took about 3 years of my life.
So what was the bike tool?
Oh, the bike tool was, it was like this stowaway tool. It's probably, I should really keep it secret, but we'll give you this one. But it was this.
I'm going to go out and steal that.
Yeah. It's this like stowaway tool that goes in your handlebars. Turns out someone else had already done a couple of things similar. So it was a multi-tool essentially. But it actually, what I learned from that, basically that experience, was it's not always a good idea to keep things completely secret and protect your IP. Because what I did was squirrel away for about 3 years. The only person who knew about it was my partner, Ailey, who I think was going crazy at the amount of time I was actually spending doing this thing. And she had actually said to me, she works in marketing and had said, in fact, a member of Story Shop, had said to me, like, make sure, get the idea out there, share it with people, get feedback. Something I didn't do on that one, and eventually when I did unveil it, it was a bit of a flop. So Potter, in contrast, basically Martin and I came up with this idea for a flat pack self-watering plant pot made of recycled materials. And straight away we kind of got the idea out there on social media. We started sharing with people, getting feedback, and actually the whole design process only took about 3 months. And after that 3 months, we launched it on Kickstarter, crowdfunding platform, and it kind of, went crazy from there. So, yeah, the actual development time was really, really quick compared to other projects.
And what was doing it? So why did you decide to do it on Kickstarter and launch that way?
Yeah, so Kickstarter, I think it was almost a bit of a pipe dream for like a long time. I think a lot of people who studied product design and kind of a lot of people followed Kickstarter as a platform for, you know, ever since its conception, probably 12, 13 years ago. And, you know, for me, it was like I'd always wanted to kind of test that way of bringing something to market. The beauty of it is that it gets rid of the kind of some of the barriers to bringing a hardware product to market in particular. So a lot of the barriers are around the upfront investment that you need to make, for example, like manufacturing tooling to bring your product to production. So through pre-orders on Kickstarter, you can essentially fund that initial, to get you over that initial hurdle. So something that I'd always be very, very interested to explore. But more than that, Kickstarter provides like a fantastic base for creating a community of people that are interested in your idea. So it's a very, very good way to test if you've got something that could ultimately become a business rather than just a product concept. Yeah.
And you were doing all this while you were working full time?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So Martin and I, we studied together, but then as fate would have it, we ended up both working together at Dyson. So I was laterally working as the kind of lead product designer, particularly on hair care category, which is why my hair is so so well kept, hair dryers, all that kind of jazz. So yeah, Martin, and actually Martin was, he was on the engineering side of hair care. So we kind of, we sit doing each other's hair in the evening, all that kind of stuff. Not really, but we did end up, you know, spending a lot of our time in the evenings, as we say, coming up with side projects. So yeah, we were spending a lot of time in work, subsequently a lot of time outside of work as well, chipping away on Potter.
How did you find that balance? I imagine it was pretty full on at Dyson and there was lots to do, but then going home and then replicating that process at home and continuing to have to tackle that.
Yeah, definitely. And you know, I know a lot of people who have kind of said to both me, Martin, and other friends that I know that also work in various side projects, it's a bit nuts to, you know, be at work all day, come home, and then spend the rest of the day working, essentially. But I don't know. I've always found like designing stuff is kind of like a creative outlet for me. So I get a lot of joy out of doing that. Definitely there's a challenge in also balancing your life. Like, again, Ailey, my partner, like we had to, we spent some time like, right, how is this going to work with also just having a general life, going out, seeing friends and that kind of thing. So there's definitely a balance to be found. And at times it definitely was quite intense. I think the good thing with Potter, because the development time actually to get us to Kickstarter was quite short, it felt like it was a kind of short sprint to get us to a place where we could test the idea. And that was really, really important compared again to the ill-fated bike tool, as I mentioned, that was years and then didn't go anywhere. So it was a bit of a crushing feeling afterwards, whereas this was, you know, short, sharp, and test the idea. And it was a success. So,
yeah. So walk us through where Potter from the Kickstarter to now, what's happened?
So yeah, it's been, the whole thing's been a bit of a whirlwind. So yeah, that was kind of midway through 2019. So that was August 2019 was when we launched our Kickstarter. I have to say, like, a huge part of the success of our launch, I do have to credit, this isn't just because I'm on the Story Shop podcast, but we obviously, you know, with yourself, Gregor, had started on that journey together a bit, and you had I guess helped us with a foot in the door with certain media outlets, this kind of thing. And that kind of catapulted us into, I guess, the product design limelight, and what kind of drove a lot of our kind of initial expansion with our business was getting into, you know, articles on like the BBC, that kind of thing. But yeah, from there, really, it was about transitioning from a product concept that we were delivering to the backers on Kickstarter, which is what we did by Christmas 2019, to transitioning to like a sustainable business, essentially. And that's like the really, really tricky part, which I'd done a fair bit of reading on it before, of how do you actually make that transition? Because one thing to like do a successful product crowdfunding campaign, and then a totally other thing to get that in a kind of repeatable, sustainable manner. So essentially, COVID hit, obviously, that kind of threw us out a bit. We actually, our initial manufacturing partner, they went under. You probably heard many stories of manufacturers you know, having to completely down tools, and this actually ended up in our production partner initially going under. So we had to completely switch supply chain, which basically set us back almost a year, actually. So quite tough, but persevered, got everything, the kind of foundations laid for the company, supply chain, website, how we were going to reach customers. And we relaunched, I'd say we launched the business properly in July last year, so July 2020, 2021, There we go. I'm a whole year out. So yeah, from 2020, July 2021, we have been essentially now ramping up the business. Big push on like direct consumer via our Shopify platform, which has been a whole learning experience in itself. And then really starting to branch out with third party retail as well. So that's kind of where we are, and lots of other things ongoing in the background, including new products in the pipeline, which is quite exciting. So,
did you ever feel like giving up at any point? I imagine when you're pretty full on with your job and then all the supply chain issues start happening, did you ever feel like packing it in?
100%. There's been a few times where, especially when our initial supplier, after we delivered the Kickstarter, because delivering the Kickstarter, like running the Kickstarter was like amazing. It was like, oh, great, like we've got all this funding. Actually delivering the Kickstarter was what I call like type two fun. So the kind of fun you look back on and you go, that was amazing. Yep. That makes for a great story. But at the time, it was quite horrible, actually. Like we were sitting folding plant pots for about 3 months and having to pack all these orders. You know, so much so that we ended up having to hire about 4 or 5 friends just to come in and help us deliver it.
I think some of those friends are doing up our office at the moment.
Yeah, they are. Yeah, shout out to Lachlan McLean. Yeah, if you're listening, thank you. I hope his fingers are still not permanently damaged. funny side story, actually, was that we employed Lachlan to essentially sit and fold these pots for us. Because our Kickstarter was overfunded, we ended up actually having a lot more orders to fulfill than we were prepared for. That was essentially the issue. So it was like a bit of a blessing and a curse at the same time. But so we hired Lachlan. The funny thing was Lachlan was about to row the Atlantic about 2 weeks after we had basically set him this rather grueling task of manually folding all these recycled polypropylene pots. And about a few days in, I remember, you know, coming to see him, and he started getting like blisters on his fingers, like calluses. So he did say after he finished the row that he thinks, you know, partly, actually, we'd almost helped him build up a layer of tough skin for actually rolling across the Atlantic. So yeah, but I was a bit worried about him. Anyway, yeah, I think in terms of, like, you know, was our point in terms of giving up? I think after we'd had the kind of elation of delivering the Kickstarter on time, we're like, oh, thank goodness. And to then go from that kind of high to then our manufacturing partner going under, and the realization that to start this business, we're almost going to have to start from scratch, essentially, and kind of work our way back up again. At that point was definitely challenging. We were still working full time at that point as well. So yeah, but I'm super glad we have persevered and kept it going, really. So.
And you're still working full time.
Yeah. You
ever see a point where you will go all in on Potter?
I mean, as long as my new employer is not listening, then yes. I mean, basically, like, so I left my last job at Dyson about seven months ago. Was doing Potter full time for that period, which was fantastic, because there was a lot of like some of the kind of groundwork and foundations that I was still kind of really laying down, and kind of making sure that, you know, if me and Martin were still working, whether that be full time or part time, that actually the foundations were there for the company and we could kind of run it ourselves with the other hours in the day that we have. But yeah, like, absolutely, the aspiration is that Potter grows as a business. We, you know, bring on new employees, and you know, I do foresee kind of throughout this year, towards the end of the year, we'll be in a quite a strong position to really start growing the business, which is, yeah, super exciting.
So what's your day-to-day involvement with Potter now? What tasks do you have to do, and what tasks do other people do?
So I'd say at the moment, the way the company's kind of split is, I personally am doing, I'd say, the kind of lion's share of a lot of the kind of day-to-day running of the business, including going after kind of, I guess, higher value kind of new business opportunities. So one of the really interesting things that's happened since starting the company is we get approached by a load of different retailers around the UK and abroad. So kind of standard people who want to distribute our products, whether that's a large supermarket chain, kind of home interiors company. So that would be kind of selling our product directly to them at large volumes, essentially. So there's those relationships that I'm managing. And then there's the more interesting ones, which are companies which are coming to us that want us to develop a custom product for them. So that is one of the things that's actually I'm spending quite a bit of time on right now, is designing new products, which will still be Potter branded and Potter manufactured, or rather they'll be co-branded with Potter and whatever company. But yeah, some of that new development is really where my focus is at the moment, because it's not just about creating the new product. Some of the kind of the size of the orders which would come along with this are like would really propel us to the next level as a business. So if we can secure one of those, then yeah, we're on to a winner.
Do you enjoy the new business side of things, of speaking to all these retailers?
Yeah, definitely. I think I'm definitely like a people person, I would say. I think anyone that knows me would describe me in that way. And, you know, I actually, even when it's not going out and actually working with new businesses, one of the things we did a lot of last year when COVID restrictions were lifted was we were doing a lot of markets. So we were at London Design Week, exhibiting there, meeting people, talking to people. We did some Christmas markets where we're actually in person selling in John Lewis for a week. And I actually love that kind of stuff. The hard sell, you know, in person, talking to potential customers. I absolutely love that. Like, that has honestly been some of the highlights for me so far, doing this kind of crazy side project business. And so, yeah, when it comes to actually meeting new businesses, building relationships, that for me is one of the most rewarding parts. And it's the same goes for like setting up our manufacturing and our supply chain. I don't think it would have been as successful if we hadn't forged like really strong relationships with those people in person. And that's actually why all of our stuff is made in the UK. We can oversee the kind of quality of our products, and that's so much easier to do when you actually can go face to face and meet people. So I think that's been really important. Yeah.
And what bits do you not like that you eventually want to give someone else to do?
I think so. There's loads and loads of kind of the. So I'll choose my words carefully. I don't not like it, but for example, there's loads of kind of admin which comes with, say, running our website, running our Knots on the High Street storefront. So we get a lot of kind of customer messages like all the time, and it could be little things like, for example, we've posted them, they're flat pack plant pots, and this arrived and one of them is missing like a cord bundle, for example, and it's maybe fallen out in the fulfillment center and the people packing it haven't quite noticed. And so you get an email being like, oh, can you organize, you know, resending a small cord bundle? And that's still me personally that's dealing with those kind of emails. And you can, as you can imagine, those kind of things add up, right? So taking, you know, having someone else kind of managing that side of it, like, do I want to be doing that forever? No. But like, do I enjoy talking to customers? Yes. So it's just, you know, I think my time can better used focused on expanding the business, which I think, you know, the aspects of it where I see the vision kind of growing as a company. So yeah, that's probably one of the main things that's kind of the more tedious side of it for sure.
But so what have you learned about running a company from working in Dyson?
I think one of the things like that I've definitely become much, much better at, it's a kind of combination of Dyson and Potter actually, because they've both taught me like so much about design development and running a business. But at Dyson, one of the things that I was very involved with was working with other like engineering departments, for example. So at Dyson, I was more focused on like the aesthetic design of the products. And what that meant is you had to work with various engineering teams, production out in the Far East. I spent quite a bit of time over in Malaysia overseeing production there. So how to actually talk to suppliers in their kind of language from a perspective of a designer is like, I think almost a bit of a skill in itself. And I think Dyson definitely gave me that exposure to be able to do that in quite a succinct and, I guess, efficient way. Because I think if you've not had that kind of hands-on experience working with suppliers face-to-face on the ground, it's quite easy for them to dominate the conversation of what you can and can't do. So I think if you're trying to do, you know, push the boundaries, do a new product that people haven't seen before, if you've got that experience, it really, really helps. So I think that undoubtedly has been one of the biggest things from Dyson that I've taken into Potter, is just how to oversee and manage that whole product development cycle.
I think when anyone starts a company, there's obviously a long list of things that you think, well, those things I wouldn't do. Is there anything that you've done, when you started Potter, you've decided I'm going to do this differently than you've seen from previous employers?
I think, so yeah, actually a good example in contrast to Dyson, right? So Dyson is like super, super top secretive about everything, even how they communicate and market their ideas. Everything is kept really, really secret right until the last second. Then they release it. And that's kind of their kind of strategy. I think as a small business, when you're trying to like grow an audience and be engaging, we found that actually being quite transparent, even with our designs at the beginning, really, really helped bring people on board, because it was quite interesting content that we could share. And it was just about being really honest about, you know, what we were struggling with, what we were achieving. And actually, I think, you know, that's definitely quite a different approach. A lot of people as well, one of the big things that feeds into is the whole conversation around IP and protecting your design. As a small startup, that can actually be really, really challenging, because one, it costs a lot of money to protect design, to protect your ideas, to get a patent, for example. And this is something we toyed with at the beginning, was do we spend the next year, you know, with lawyers trying to protect our concept before we've even tested it? Or do we take the risk that we launch it and it's a success, but people copy us? And we did the latter. To this day, I've not seen a knockoff Nigel version of Potter Pots yet. I'm kind of expecting it may come at some point, but our kind of strategy has been essentially build a strong brand. And the way we've done that is by taking people on that journey and kind of showing them exactly how we've built the business. And then hopefully they're then invested in us as a brand, and they're not going to buy the kind of knockoff version, essentially. So, I think that's a very different approach to keeping all your cards close to your chest, which is, yeah. Other previous employers that I've worked with, definitely that would be their approach. So.
Well, wasn't that interesting? I can't wait to hear what they say next. If you're looking for something for your eyes to do while you're listening to this fascinating interview, why not visit our website at wearestoryshop.com. There, you can do it all. Sign up for our newsletters filled with witty commentary, read all the lovely things our clients have to say about us, meet the team, and find our social media channels so you can keep up to date with all the stories we're telling. That's wearestoryshop.com. Now back to the interview. And with your skill set, is there a temptation to start multiple companies and try loads of different things?
Yeah, I mean, I guess my brain is always ticking over for the next thing to reinvent or design in a different way. So undoubtedly there are other things, even between Martin and I, like every now and again we'll see, you know, we'll look at some kind of product, and it not necessarily got anything to do with the botanical industry whatsoever. And there is a temptation, but I think for me, actually, the bread and butter bit for myself is the design side. And actually the part that I'm really enjoying and learning a lot from is the growing the business side. Mm-hmm. So actually for me at the moment, like I'm getting a lot of satisfaction out of, you know, focusing on one thing and trying to maintain and grow that, rather than having a kind of more scattergun. I'll, you know, design a plant pot today, but I'll try redesign a phone tomorrow. Like, mm-hmm. Actually, for me right now, I'm quite happy just keeping quite focused. So we'll definitely be doing other products, but they'll be within the same kind of theme of mm-hmm. the botanical world.
And in that learning of building a business, have you made any mistakes that you look back on?
Yeah. I think even from the Kickstarter, there was like, biggest one was, so you have options of where you sell on Kickstarter, right? You can limit it to the UK, you can go completely global. And we kind of, I guess maybe our eyes were bigger than our stomach in this case. And we basically were like, right, let's go global. We'll sell them everywhere. And we did, and we got, you know, amazing response. But it wasn't until afterwards, we'd done a bit of homework on how much it would cost to ship to these different places, but we hadn't properly researched it. And, this massively came back to bite us in the ass, because we were charging people, say, £10 for shipping to New Zealand. And then when we actually went to pack our products into the packaging we were using, it worked out to be like £25. So in some cases, we were getting absolutely stung per shipment. So, you know, that was a massive learning. And now at the moment, as a small business, our, you know, the majority of our customers are UK-based. We offer international shipping to places like the US, Canada, Europe. But, you know, people are paying quite a hefty fee to get them there. And I mean, it's amazing. People are actually, I'm still gobsmacked that people are willing to pay these fees to receive our products. And, you know, that's a huge boost of confidence for us, because once we have, say, a distributor in the US, if anyone in the US is listening and wants to be a distributor, then please get in touch. But, you know, there's huge potential there, essentially. But yeah, I think that's one of the big ones. I think one of the big ones we got right from the beginning, and which was actually, I guess, given to me as advice from another product designer that I know that had also, he'd started a failed business and then went on to do a successful one. And it was about never being too early to start growing your kind of audience and your network mm-hmm. for who's going to become ultimately your customers. And again, that from day one, when we had this idea of kind of reinventing the plan pot, as niche as it was, we were like, right, let's get onto Instagram, reach out to people, start sharing some ideas. And to begin with, it was all just basically photographs of origami making, origami patterns with photos of plants. That was how it actually started. And yeah, essentially, that's the approach we took. It was a very clear decision on day one, like, right, let's start building an audience. And that, yeah, reaped dividends when, you know, 6 months down the line, we actually had a customer base mm-hmm. already there that had been following the progress. So,
and where do you want Potter to go?
Oh, take over the world of plant pots. Where do we want Potter to go? So Potter started as a kind of, as I said, a case study in what does sustainability look like as a core design requirement for redesigning a product. What I want to do is grow our base of products that we apply that ethos to and essentially create a company which is kind of sustainability from the ground up, but as applied to a range of kind of household products. To begin with, within the botanical sphere, you know, our product is kind of rooted in horticulture, flora, like this kind of thing. But yeah, ultimately it's about showcasing a different way of approaching design, which I don't think enough people do at the moment. Actually, one of my pet hates on this point is so many products right now, and loads of companies I've worked for in the past have been guilty of this, is you design a product and then retrospectively you go, oh shit, like sustainability is kind of on trend right now. Mm-hmm. So how do we retrospectively make it seem green, in inverted commas? And so that's when you maybe introduce a little bit of recycled material, and you know, companies will be like, I've seen like Adidas trainers which are like, you know, made from recycled ocean plastic, and it's like you look up the small print and it's like the sole is made of 2% plastic reclaimed from the ocean, and it's like, it's just bullshit, it's just like marketing waffle basically. And actually what you should be doing is at the beginning of the design process thinking, right, what are all the different contributing factors into this product's life, like the entire life cycle, which are going to make it sustainable, right? For us, actually, the biggest one, as I said, was for a traditional plant pot made of concrete or ceramic, if you're shipping that around the world, shipping it to customers, because it's heavy, because it's fragile, and because it's actually not a very suitable material for that application, that is one of the biggest contributing factors to its carbon footprint. That's why our product is flat packs, because it massively saves on carbon footprint emissions due to shipping, because it's much more efficient. So it's that kind of like ground up approach that we want to see with Potter. And I think it's really resonating with people. Like, customers understand that it's a holistic picture you need to be kind of painting with product design. And, you know, so I really want to just expand our brand and keep applying that ethos to the products that we create, and ultimately have a kind of product portfolio that we're proud of, really proud of, and that customers also kind of can see why we're doing it. So, yeah.
When did you first realize you had an aptitude for design and you were capable of this type of thing?
So again, going back to the old school years, I think actually at school, interestingly, like I knew, like I liked art, right? So I was like, oh, maybe I could be a fine artist, even though actually I was not that good at art. Like I was okay. You know, I could stay within the lines when colouring in, but not a kind of Picasso or Rembrandt. But and then the other side, I was good at maths and good at physics, right? So I was like, I remember actually like speaking to my dad at the time. He was always like, you know, well, maths and physics, that'll get you a good job kind of thing. Go out and that'll get you a secure job. Art you can do in your spare time. And school I went to, I guess the subjects were kind of somewhat traditional. Like it didn't necessarily say like, oh, there's this thing that combines art and engineering, or sorry, art and maths, for example. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until it was like an open day when I went up to Glasgow University, and I bumped into this guy who was an engineer, but he was actually doing the course that I went on to do. So he was in the mechanical engineering department, but he said, well, of course there's a way of combining these skills. You study product design with engineering. And that was like the light bulb moment, basically. This guy, Sam Smith, who now actually works he's like head of design for Apple, actually, in head of design engineering, who interviewed me when I went out there for an interview a number of years ago. And he was very—he was the toughest interview I've ever had. So, like, yeah, hands down. I think he.
What was interviewing for Apple like?
It was the most terrifying experience I think I've ever done. So, I guess to give some context for the listeners, right now we're in a small room, maybe about 5 feet by 5 feet in this podcast studio. It was about a room the same size as that, no windows, all white, like whiteboard walls. And I don't know if you've seen the movie Good Will Hunting, uh-huh. with all the maths on the whiteboard. Imagine basically 9 hours in a room, nine individual one-to-one interviews, each focused on a different subject of maths or physics, basically. So to give you an example, one of the one-hour interviews was on thermodynamics. Another one of the one-hour interviews was on like non-Newtonian mechanics. And it literally was like, here's a pen. Here's a pen. I want you to solve this problem. And these were like the guys, obviously at Apple. Like they're all geniuses. They're all like Einsteins in their own right. And one of the guys, I remember the first guy who interviewed me. His name was Matt, and he came in. I'm going to put on a terrible American accent now, but he came in. And he was like, "Hey, Andy, nice to meet you, man." He was like, "My name's Matt. I'm an MIT grad, and today we're going to be doing an entire interview on tolerance stacking." I had no idea what tolerance stacking was at this point in time. Like, I hadn't even studied it. And I was like, oh, fuck, here we go. And yeah, basically, he handed me a pen. He drew this crazy equation and he was like, handed me the pen. And he said, okay, Andy, I want you to solve this problem. I kid you not, it was the longest, like, 30 seconds of my life just staring blankly at the whiteboard, to the point at which I was actually doing that thing where in my head I was going, I was basically going like, what would happen right now if I just chucked the pen at this guy and just ran out of the room? Like, I was like absolutely freaking out. And eventually he ended up, he was really nice. He helped me through the problem. But yeah, it was very, very tough. But by the end of the day, essentially going back to the Good Will Hunting reference, there was I was the Matt Damon, but without the genius, basically. I was just like writing all over the walls, but most of it wrong. So I didn't get the job, but it was good fun. I had a week in California, Cupertino. So that was good. But yeah, tough, basically. All very nice, but all scarily intelligent, yeah.
So when you were younger, when you first started out in product design, what were some of your first products that you created?
So at Glasgow School of Art, where I did product design, there were a whole number of projects they kind of, I guess, got you to design, exposed you to try and, you know, increase your understanding of the world of design and engineering and how the two link together. And I remember one of the ones that I used to get slagged off for years afterwards was basically it was a challenge to redesign an electric kitchen knife in the style of IKEA, right? And I for some reason had in my head that it would be a really cool idea. I'd basically seen this technology called water jet cutting, which is quite a common process used for cutting steel, right? So it's literally like it's an abrasive water jet, super high pressure. It's like 200 kilopascals or something, absolutely crazy amounts of pressure, and it's a gigantic machine. My kind of naivety at the time, I was like, oh well, imagine you could use water to cut bread in your kitchen. No idea why, like, who wants soggy cut bread, right? It's a terrible idea, but I just thought it sounded cool and kind of techie. This was in my first year of uni. And I designed this. And I remember a week before the end of the project, I reviewed it with our head of department. And he was just like, what the fuck have you done, basically? Like, this is, like, he was like, no, just go back. You've got a week. Go back to stage one and redesign, basically, in the style of IKEA. But, yeah, it was a terrible idea. I got slagged off for it. You know, I still get slagged off for it by my ex-classmates at the time. But to be honest, actually, it was kind of like a... feeds quite nicely into the idea of kind of like wrong thinking and doing inverted commas for wrong thinking. That was one of the interesting things. Like that was a Dyson cliche, actually, was that got used in the kind of internal comms at Dyson all the time. You know, that everyone there was wrong thinkers or unconventional thinking. But I do like that ethos. And I think it's one of the things that I think differentiates, say, like product designers with maybe standard engineers, because we kind of approach things differently a lot of the time. We kind of challenge conventional thinking, conventional manufacturing processes, and try and kind of push the boundaries. And a lot of the time, like the water jet knife in your kitchen, probably could be a terrible idea, but sometimes it just sparks a little bit of kind of genius, which leads to something nice. And I think that was actually Potter, like flat pack origami plant pots. That was, I think, a nice example of that kind of unconventional thinking. So,
looking at your journey, do you think there's a problem in education that it doesn't really encourage that wrong thinking? You, someone who's clearly flourished in that environment, and then you were through school, you thought you were going to either go down a path of maths or physics and write answers.
I think, undoubtedly, I think there are some schools that are better than others as well, at kind of fostering that kind of thinking. Like, I think school I went to, you know, it's just run-of-the-mill state school, good school. I enjoyed it, but yeah, the subjects themselves were very standard, and the kind of the advice you got was like, you know, you could study science and become a doctor. You could, you know, study modern studies and English and become a lawyer. Do you know, it was that kind of, those kind of career trajectories, which, I definitely don't think there's maybe enough, kind of creative thought actually just put into thinking about what those careers could be. I do think there's a kind of tendency to kind of go for the kind of safe routes, the safe options, the ones that people know and have heard of. And maybe, maybe not such a focus on kind of exploring the, you know, the wider sphere of things you could go on to do. You know, that's just speaking from my experience of one school in, you know, thousands of schools.
I think at one school is probably pretty standard to a lot of the different schools because they're all under the same curriculum, essentially.
Yeah. I mean, I do know there was some other schools. In fact, actually, interestingly, so one of the schools, I guess, in the catchment area next to the one I went to, I later found out after school that they actually offered product design as a as like an elective course you could do in, I think, your fifth year of school or something, which, even though we were under the same, you know, Eastern Bartonshire area, even though we're under the same, I guess, council area, there was actually some different discrepancies in subjects being offered. And yeah, maybe I would have kind of come across product design sooner had it been I was at that school rather than the one I went to. But yeah, I think definitely in general there's still a kind of tendency to kind of, you know, prioritize the kind of safe, you know, structured kind of career options like doctors, lawyers, nurses, etc. So
how could they make it different?
I think it stems from, first of all, having people, like, it's interesting, like, I've got friends who've gone into teaching, for example, and, you know, the people that I know that have gone into teaching are really, really passionate about their subjects, and I think will become fantastic teachers. I always remember my parents, who studied languages, they studied, like, French, Spanish, German, that was one of their kind of career options, right? After studying languages, become a teacher. It's quite a standard career path, perhaps, for people who've studied that kind of subject. And I remember at the time them saying, or when I got older, they were like, loads of our friends ended up going down that route. But they didn't actually want to be teachers. They basically, it was like they like an obvious choice for them. So I think the point I'm getting to is that I think some of it stems from the teachers themselves. Like, if they're not passionate about actually wanting to be a teacher and imparting kind of inspiring, you know, younger generations, then I think there's a bit of an issue there. So I think, you know, we want people to be in those roles who actually are going to inspire kids and who themselves are going to kind of maybe challenge conventional thinking as to what it is that people should be doing. Mm-hmm. And then, obviously at a higher kind of government level, I think they need to also be looking at, you know, not all, you know, prioritizing these kind of standard conventional routes for careers and kind of giving people the kind of space to explore these other options. So,
It feels to me like people like you who are, you know, a completely different skill set, who have been able to follow down that path, then probably won't ever go into teaching. So it's very hard to foster that in young people because they won't go down that path because you'd have to have that lived experience in that area. And I think that counts for a lot of different sectors. And I think if there was a bit of an opening up where people like you would be able to at least do a little bit of teaching.
And to be honest, that is something that I'm actually quite passionate about. And like already, like I already do quite a lot of work with Glasgow School of Art to give back to like the students there. And obviously there are students that have, you know, they've already chosen, they know what kind of degree they're doing. So some of them are, you know, it's a bit of a captive audience, right? They're already doing product design. But I also, even when I was at Dyson, I was on the kind of elective program to go out and do workshops at schools. So I actually came back up to Scotland a number of times to do. Visited a school in Falkirk, one over in the East Coast somewhere, to try and inspire kids to go into, you know, at least kind of STEM based subjects. That's what I'm passionate about. And yeah, the response that we had every single time was like unbelievable. Like I remember in the school in Falkirk doing this work, like a Dyson workshop essentially. And basically it consisted of all of these just like random kind of leftover kind of broken bits of Dyson machines. And basically you give them to the kids and say like, invent something. Like, what can you come up with? And these were like, these kids were like 10 and it was a total riot. Like you had kids like making bazookas and then like lobbing things across the classroom when you weren't looking. But it was kind of like, mad chaos, but like also really productive at the same time. And I actually, that kind of thing, like they absolutely loved it, like really, really loved it. And it was like really cool to see that you had these kids that you could tell were actually really excited about this. And you know, I've done it with different age groups as well, like even like latter year kind of, you know, fifth, 6 year kids in Scotland like get really, really excited because you kind of open their eyes to like, look, you're studying maths, which right now you find kind of dry and a bit boring. But this is the kind of thing you could be doing, right? You could be designing the next Apple, you know, iPhone. You could be designing, you know, anything, the next Brompton bike. Like, it's like there's so many options to go into with it. So I think it's kind of showing that, having that link to the kind of thing you could end up doing with these subjects that's kind of missing maybe for me. Mm-hmm. It's kind of showing like, okay, with this, with standard, you know, doing your higher maths and doing that well, you could actually be designing something that's really, really epic, that, you know, a product that they love using day to day. So I think that's a good way to kind of get people inspired.
So day to day, what products frustrate you?
Oh, what products frustrate me? Do you know, it's funny actually, because for someone that works in product design and tech, I'm really not someone that's very into tech products. So I kind of don't have like a huge arsenal of techie products, but what frustrates me?
That could be like the cup holder in my car that doesn't fit a coffee cup.
Oh, and yeah, no, absolutely. I think there are certain things. Well, I'm quite a keen cyclist, for example, and I think there are certain things on my current road bike that I would probably love to have a crack at redesigning. This is kind of why I ended up in this journey of designing bike tool, right? Because one of the things that really frustrates me with multi-tools is the kind of plethora of different kind of objects that you need to end up carrying with you. So you go out on a kind of lightweight road bike cycle and you end up carrying half a ton of stuff with you. That's definitely a frustration. I've got more niche ones within like the snowboarding and kind of worlds, because that's another one of my big passions. Snowboard tools, again, I'm very tool focused, but they're awful. Snowboard tools are terrible. One is like carrying them in your pocket. Often they're not designed to be very safe, so often they have got like an exposed, you know, Phillips end, so if you fall over, you do a jump, you fall over, you end up puncturing your side or something like that. And yeah, how you actually use those when your hands are at like minus 10, for example, and it's really cold, they've just not been very well thought through, a lot of them. So there's a couple of examples. I'm sure there's loads more, but I've got a brain blank, drawing a blank.
Right, well, have you had a chance to think about your pre-prepared responses?
I completely forgotten about them, but let's remind me and I'll see if I...
Right. If there was a film of your life, who would play you?
A film of my life, who would play me? Oh, yeah, so I thought about this one. I had to go with someone ginger, because for the listeners, I am a redhead, a proud redhead. So I can't even remember his real name, but I was thinking Ron Weasley. So I like thinking of myself as maybe like a better-looking version of Ron Weasley, let's say that, but... he, you know, a nice kind of got a touch of magic. He's maybe second to Harry Potter. Maybe I'm second to Martin. I'm not sure, but
I don't know. I've never seen a minute or read a word of Harry Potter.
Really?
Yep.
Wow, that's an interesting fact
about me.
I'm not even a Harry. I don't even really like Harry Potter. But I think there's a number of times people have been like, "Oh, you're like Ron Weasley." So there you go. Or to be honest, whoever the ginger flavor of the month is, that's who I am. So it's Ed Sheeran or Prince Harry or whoever it is. It used to be LaRue, which, you know, the female singer LaRue at the time, because my hair was similar to that. So that was quite a funny one. But yeah, so there you go.
And the first song on the soundtrack of that film?
All the Rage by Funeral for a Friend. There you go. Bring out the old school emo in me. Yeah, we'll do that. All the Rage, great
and
song.
What would your autobiography be called?
Going Potty. I can't. Okay, there was a pre-prepared one that Gregor gave me, and I can't even remember.
It's very similar. It's all going to Potter.
It's all going to Potter, yeah. Yeah, I mean, let's hope that's not how it goes, and it all goes swimmingly. But yeah, that probably is. That's how my mind's going anyway. All going to Potter, yeah.
And do you want to give a shout-out to one business you love?
Yeah, so one that I was thinking about earlier is a company called Filament PD. They're a kind of product design consultancy based in Glasgow. Yeah, I know the guys who founded it, and yeah, they've done an awesome job of kind of, I think, fostering the kind of product design community in Glasgow. And you know, they're really growing in a pretty awesome way at the moment and doing all sorts of interesting initiatives. So yeah.
Is there anything that people would know from what they've designed?
I think of like a specific one off the top of my head. There's actually a random one that my friend worked on it was a Marks and Spencer's coffee dispensing machine. So if you go into any M&S and you see the coffee dispensing machines, then they're designed by them. Which maybe, I don't know if you've ever used one, Gregor. Probably not.
I have never used a Marks and Spencer's coffee machine.
No, because you love coffee and you wouldn't go near one of those. But apparently they're very good. So, But no, they do. They've got like loads of different clients. But yeah, just really cool stuff. I think they're doing a really good job. So yeah,
nice. Well, thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you ever so much. Yeah, that was good fun. Thank you for letting me ramble about Potter and my life story, apparently, for the last little while. So, yeah, thank you very much for having me.
Thank you very much for listening. If you know a purpose-driven entrepreneur with a story worth telling who would make for a great guest on the Story Shop podcast, send us a message on social media. We're at We Are Story Shop on all channels.